This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And joining me today is author Kathleen Grissom. She is the New York Times best-selling author of the books The Kitchen House and Glory Over Everything. Her latest book is called Crow Mary. This is a book about a woman known as Goes First, as she was called by her people. And we are visiting now with Kathleen about the incredible life of this woman. Kathleen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Ashley.
So you found out about this woman and the remarkable life that she led at a history event. What first captivated you about Goes First?
Well, about 20 years ago, I was visiting my parents in Saskatchewan. I'm Canadian and I'm from Saskatchewan originally. So we decided as a day trip to go over to a place called Fort Walsh. This was in Saskatchewan, and it was where the Northwest Mounted Police had built their first fort. So we thought it would just be a nice outing. And on the prairie of Saskatchewan, as you're driving along, you come to a place called the Cypress Hills. And out of nowhere, there's this nice, beautiful, flat prairie. And suddenly you have these beautiful rolling hills that are covered with fir trees. And that is where the Northwest Mounted Police built their first fort. So while we were there, there were docents who were dressed up and telling us about how this building, the fort, came to be. But over on the side, off in the distance, I saw a young woman who was dressed as a Native woman. And she was speaking, and I went over and I heard her say, and she was acting the part of Crow Mary, and she said, my name is Crow Mary, and I was 16 years old, and I was here at the time when a massacre happened of 40 Nakota natives. I was here, and I watched when they were murdering them. The wolfers, these were the bad men, took four of the native women back to the fort, and they were going to rape them and murder them. But I single-handedly took my two guns, and I went in to save them. She was 16 years old at the time, and while this woman was talking, I just had this deep chill go through me, and I thought, I meant to write her story. I was still working on The Kitchen House at that time, so that was 20 years ago, but I just knew that I was meant to write her story.
Yeah.
So that was the very beginning.
Yeah, a teenager single-handedly taking on very violent, very drunk men in a place and time that was not at all friendly to Indigenous people. How did you do the research for this book? There's not much out on the internet about her even now.
No, there isn't. I was just really fortunate. I went online, started online, and I found, of all things, I found her great-granddaughter, Nedra Brown. So that was where I began. I was then introduced to elders at the Crow Reservation, and I had this amazing support all along from the Crow people themselves, encouraging me to tell Crow Mary's story. Mm.
Certainly, white people have not given Indigenous people a lot of reasons to trust them. How did you communicate with the elders and the people of this Crow community in such a way that allowed you to get the story and then tell it in a way that was culturally appropriate?
I had two people in particular. One was Janine Pease. She is the founder of the Little Bighorn College out at the Crow Reservation. I felt kind of intimidated when I went to see her because I thought she was going to be this really, I don't know, strong, tough kind of woman because she had founded the college, of course. And I had been told by so many people, you have to meet her. She's such a powerful, strong woman, and you'll be so impressed with her. So I finally did manage to get a meeting with her, and I went to her office, and that was on campus. And I went into her room expecting this really, as I said, a really strong, powerful woman. And she was sitting in just a tiny little office. And on her, she had a granddaughter on her lap. And I just looked at her and I sort of got tears in my eyes. And I just said, I'd been thinking about goes first as this really strong, tough woman. And when I saw you, Janine, I knew that she could be strong and powerful, but she didn't have to be that picture that I had had in my head. So that was the beginning with Janine, and Janine was just so encouraging and so gracious every time I called.
Yeah.
There was another elder as well, Janice Wilson, Bird of Excellence, and she was the woman that I really relied on over the past 5, 6, 7 years to help me out with the language and with the cultural differences.
That's a really interesting answer that you just gave in looking at Janine and thinking about goes first and this word power that was automatically in your mind associated with, you know, a sort of ferocity and yet true power can be in loving and in leading. Mm-hmm. How did your relationship or your understanding of the word power change in going through the research and doing a book like this?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because at the very beginning when I was starting to do research, I found just little tidbits about Cro-Mary. And it was true, her white name, her given name, was Cro-Mary, but she was also known as Big Mary. She was known as Mean Mary. And these were by men that were some real tough people in that day and age. So that's where I really fully expected her to be this really tough, strong, formidable character. And then when I saw Janine, I just knew immediately that that was part of Cro-Mary's makeup. I just knew that she would be strong, and she was. She had to have been incredibly strong.
Mm-hmm.
But there was, it came from within. And it was a belief in herself that she could do what she needed to do.
Yeah.
And then did that.
There is absolutely a ferociousness that does come to play in the book, as you mentioned, during the massacre and the follow-up to that. But let's go back in time just a little bit. How did she even end up in this part of Canada and leaving her Crow people and the ancestral homelands and following this white man who came to be her husband?
Mm-hmm. Well, Abe Farwell was a well-known fur trader at that time, and he was known as a good man. He was known to be a good man. So, and he had a good relationship with different Native tribes, so it was not a stretch for her to be taken as his wife. And it was a mutual agreement. She wanted this as well. And it would have been considered at that time to be a positive thing for the Crow people. The Crow were friendly with the white people because they needed allies against some of their enemies. So it wasn't really a stretch for her to marry him and go with him. What was unusual is that he actually married her. There's documentation of their marriage. And but she was also a 16-year-old girl married to a 36-year-old man and came from the Crow people. So she was suddenly taken into this white world, and a very tough white world.
Mm-hmm.
And one can only imagine what that must have been like.
Yeah. And they together as a couple were running this trading post. Her presence was supposed to sort of soften the relations and allow more Indigenous and Native people to come in and feel comfortable, her being fluent, of course, in her language, and then also in something called hand talk. Let's quickly just talk about what is hand talk.
Well, it would be today what is known as hand signals, or what the deaf use. So it was a very sophisticated means of communication that was used by all tribes on the prairie. So it was very sophisticated.
Mm-hmm. And the early parts of their marriage, do seem, by all accounts in the book and based on your research, to have been pretty happy, which wasn't always the case when there was a mixed marriage like that. Mm-hmm. But we do get to a point where there is some extreme violence. Can you set our listeners up with what was going on at the time that there was this big blowout? It started with an accusation, a false accusation of horse thievery.
Yes. Well, there were some, there were wolfers. There were men called wolfers. And the reason they were called wolfers was because they used strychnine and they poisoned carcasses of buffalo. And that would then, all of the animals would come to eat, the prairie animals would come to eat from them. And what they were after, they were after wolves, of course. They were after the wolf pelts. Mm-hmm. So these wolfers were not liked one little bit by any of the native people. And because a lot of their own animals would be killed in this way. So these wolfers were a tough, tough group of men. They were white men. A lot of them now, they talk about how they really suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder because they had come from the war, from the Civil War, and they came out west. And a lot of them were just bloodthirsty. And so this was the group of people, or this was the group of men that showed up at the trading post when Crow Mary was there.
And one of them accused a group of Nakota men of stealing a horse.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And then what ensues from there? Without giving away too much of the book, but we have mentioned what does happen. So,
well, we know that there was this massacre that happened. And how many Nakota people were killed, were brutally slain, really, we're not quite sure. But was one of the numbers that was given in the trial that happened as a result of this massacre was 40, that 40 were brutally killed. And Crow Mary was there while it happened.
And she saw these women being taken. She takes it upon herself at 16 years old. And she herself, an incredibly good shot, had won a lot of not exactly bar bets, but for want of a better term, sort of some bar bets of throwing things up in the air and then shooting them, very much in the style of the stories that you hear about Annie Oakley. And mm-hmm. and she goes and rescues these women. Mm-hmm. I wonder, as I was reading the book, I thought, I don't think I could have done that. How did
I
you
know,
put
but
your?
We don't know, do we?
Well, true, we don't know. but I wonder, as an author, how did you put yourself in a headspace of somebody who really is that right-minded and brave and able to act?
Well, I always say with my writing, what I try to do is my part is to do the research and get to know the area. I had to know the area. I had to know her, what she would have been motivated by and what her fears would have been. I had to know the topography and know exactly the layout of the place and what it would have looked like. I would get up at night at the time where I thought that she would be sitting in the trees and studying the fort.
Wow.
And just studying that time of day, studying that time of night to see what she would be looking at. But once I had all of that down, once I understood that, once it was inside of me, I then got out of the way. And then I let the character come through. And I pick up my pencil and I follow behind her. So I don't tell her what to do. She goes ahead and does it. And I follow and I write what she does.
Yeah.
That's how I do my writing.
Mm-hmm. How does that work? I mean, do you have to meditate? do you know how this comes to you?
No, I really do not. But I do meditate. And I do believe that there is a higher power, a God. And I ask every day for direction. And I feel right from the beginning with Crow Mary, as I did with the other two books, I felt that I was meant to do this. But I also know that Kathy isn't doing it, that Kathy needs to get out of the way. So I need to do my homework. That I need to do, and I know that.
Yeah.
And the research is my homework. But then the characters come through. So that was why it was so important for me to understand her culturally, to an intimate understanding of her culture, so that she could then feel confident to be able to speak through me. Now, that's the way I see it.
We're visiting today with New York Times bestselling author Kathleen Grissom about her latest book, Crow Mary. You can find out more about Kathleen and about her other books at KathleenGrissom.com, and that's spelled G-R-I-S-S-O-M. As we are reading about this massacre in the book, there is a scene where older women, grandmother sort of age, mm-hmm. are shot mm-hmm. unarmed in the back as they are fleeing. This mm-hmm. at a time when pioneers, when settlers were referring to the First Nations people as savages. Mm-hmm. Who are the real savages in this book? Do I even need to ask?
Yeah. Well, I think that, honestly, if we can step back in time, it was a different time and it was a different place.
Hmm.
There is always where you have greed and power, there's almost always an abuse of that. And there certainly was that here. But I also, as I was doing the research, as I was studying the culture of the Crow people, I was shocked at how little I knew mm-hmm. about them as a people. I was shocked at how they're highly sophisticated. They have a highly sophisticated culture. And they're very, very spiritual. But it's very complex and complicated. And I don't wonder that when I look back and I look back at my ancestors, who clearly didn't have any comprehension of other cultures, didn't have the time, the wherewithal, just were trying to earn a living or trying to just survive, how they would not have understood the culture and how the indigenous people wouldn't have understood the white culture either. Two totally different cultures, two totally different ways of looking at things.
The fallout of the massacre becomes a real point of tension between Crow Mary and her husband, Abe. She mentions throughout the book that the Crow people would have had a way to restore justice. Mm-hmm. And Abe is very much convinced of this idea of the trial and that going through the proper channels and the legal system is the best, most sophisticated way.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about the legacy of the trial, what they were up against at the time and what this trial has meant in the understanding of the relations between these two groups of people?
Well, I don't know that I am the person to really go in depth with that, because we have up in Canada, we have historians who have studied that and do study that today. But from my point of view, I believe that right from the beginning, there just wasn't going to be a fair chance for any kind of real justice to be done. And that was because there was just such heavy weight lent to the fur traders at that time, or to the whiskey traders and to these wolfers, because there was so much money that was dependent, big business was dependent mm-hmm. On their survival and their doing well, and their continuing on to do what they did, to just get in there and decimate anyone that was in the way, including any tribes. So that was the way I saw it. The legacy itself, I can only speak for in Crow Mary's life, and the legacy, the toll that that took on that marriage, which I won't go into, so I won't mm-hmm. spoil the story for people. But it definitely had very lasting repercussions. and probably still does to this day. I think historically does to this day.
In the intro to the book, there is a line that describes you this way. She sees her task as a spiritual one, to bring untold stories to life. That word, spiritual, do you agree?
For me, all of this has been a spiritual gift. I see it as a spiritual gift. And the reason I say that was because with my very first with The Kitchen House, I hadn't intended ever to write a book, and I came to it late in life. I first started when I was around 50. But this inspiration, this obsession to learn about why this handwritten title of Negro Hill was written on a map just became an obsession. And I started to follow that and follow that. And I just knew inside of me that I was meant to write about that without having a clue of how to write, without having the education for it or the background for it. I just knew I was meant to do that. So I trusted that. I went with that. And sure enough, it appeared to be the right move. So, and I just sort of follow through with the rest of it like that. With my other two, I followed through like that. Certainly with Cro-Mary, I felt that same obsession and that same drive.
Are you working on anything right now?
Actually, I'm taking a rest.
Oh, good for you.
This has been a long, this has been a long, long time. I've been researching almost over 20 years for this latest one, for Cro-Mary.
Wow.
And I need a rest right now. But we'll see. People always ask me, I speak to many, many book clubs, and they always ask me, how did I ever come to write, and especially at a later age? So I've sort of been toying with the idea of working with some of the journals I kept at that time and maybe writing something about how I came to write at that age and how that came about.
Well, please send it our way when you do get that book written.
Kathleen, okay, I'll remember that.
Kathleen Grissom, the author of Cro-Mary. You can find out more at kathleengrissom.com. Thank you so much for your time today.
I appreciate your inviting me very much.
We'll have more Main Street after this news.
Good afternoon. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. North Dakota's Department of Water Resources has issued its final version of the Hazard Classification and Legacy Dams Policy.
A dams classification represents the hazards that are presented downstream if a dam were to fail.
DWR Regulatory Division Director Aaron Carranza says the dams are classified as high, medium, and low.
Prior to this recent effort, our high hazard dam definition allowed for the loss of more than a few lives before that classification was triggered, and this did no longer represent the state of the practice. So last year in 2022, we went through a rulemaking effort to update North Dakota Administrative Code to change the definition of a high hazard dam that would be triggered if there were any loss of life.
Carranza says of the approximately 3,000 dams in North Dakota, which includes stock dams, the vast majority are termed low-level risk. Another 63 are medium-level, and around 50 are high-level.
This policy is designed to help those that are currently owners of dams to know how their actions could play into the policy changes for if they want to make any improvements to their structures, as well as provide transparent guidance on how the hazard classification process will be completed for those looking to construct new dams.
The new policy took effect June 2nd. North Dakota's annual Quit Week is running June 11th through the 17th. The statewide initiative is focused on raising awareness of the dangers of tobacco and alternative nicotine products. Brady Weaver is Health Promotions Director at Western Plains Public Health. Weaver says this is a major week in the year to encourage North Dakotans to set a date to quit.
Our smoking rates in North Dakota have gone down kind of across the board, where we're also seeing increase in the usage for youth and adults with vape products. So it's a pretty large concern. We don't know long-term effects of vaping for the most part at this point. So You know, we focus on cigarette use, cigar use, but also vape products, spit tobacco, everything. It's all a large problem, and we want to be there for people when they're ready to quit.
Weaver says he's seeing a dangerous trend of people turning toward vapes in order to quit, even though vaping is just as harmful as traditional cigarettes. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Touchmark at Harwood Groves Fargo and on West Century in Bismarck. Touchmark offers maintenance-free living so residents have more time to enjoy what they love. Fresh prepared meals, health and fitness club, and a full calendar of events with friends nearby. Learn more at touchmark.com.
Bill Bryson goes on a journey getting to know the old house he bought.
Never in history has domesticity changed so radically and so quickly.
Pico Iyer searches for paradise.
Places have a magnetism, as people do, and they have a power.
And Jeff Speck explores what makes a city livable.
And then all of a sudden you have a city in which it's better to bike in and better to walk in.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tomorrow at 8 Central, here on Prairie Public.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Prairie Yard and Garden is a 30-minute television show about gardening in the upper Midwest. It airs at 5:30 a.m. and 12:30 p.m. on Saturdays on Prairie Public Television. With us to learn more about this show that has been around for a long time is Mary Holm, host of Prairie Yard and Garden. Mary, welcome to Main Street.
Well, thank you so much for having us.
And also with us is Mike Seahawk. He's the Prairie Yard and Garden Executive Producer. Welcome, Mike.
Wow, thanks for having us.
And we're going to start this with a riddle. Okay, now my wife and I have a new build here in the Fargo area. We live in Horace. And our granddaughter was talking to us about our gardens and came at us with this. Papa, she said, what kind of garden does a baker usually have? The answer is a flower garden, you guys. Come on.
She's on it.
She is. So you guys have been doing this show for a long time, and it has really changed over the years. Take us back, what, 35, 36, now 37 years ago to the very beginnings of the show.
Yeah, absolutely. It started back in the mid-80s. Our home PBS station is Pioneer Public over in now Granite Falls. And they were seeking a show that they had seen in Nebraska that illustrated gardening and that sort of thing. They approached us at the University of Minnesota Morris, my predecessor Roger Bowman, to see if we would be interested in producing such a show. And so they had a pilot program. I think it was like 4 or 5 episodes. They got a little bit of funding to do it, and it was a live show.
It was live.
And Morris is about 30 minutes from when it was when Pioneer PBS was over in Appleton, Minnesota. And so it was live. We had a studio space here. They did it. They did it for about 5-6 shows. That was it. It was well received. The next season, they had no funding, but they still did it. They did a smaller season. And by about year 3 or 4, it got up to 24 live shows from October to the end of March.
That's a full season. You bet.
It's a huge season.
Yeah.
And so I came in after season 8. So I grew up just across the river from you over in Barnesville, Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Went to school at Morehead State, then called Morehead State. And I came to the University of Minnesota Morris for work. And that was one of the jobs that I had, or one of the tasks I had, is to be associated with that program. And it was live for until about 15 years ago, 16 maybe now. And now it's strictly on location magazine style.
Showing these beautiful, stunning gardens that might be right in our neighbor's yard that maybe
absolutely
we might not even know about.
So what we started to do a few of those segments where we go on the road, and they're so well received that we had to go where the gardens were or where the people were. And so we just developed it into now it's a 13 show season, because on location is a little bit more work. And we visit every kind of corner of the area and the whole upper Midwest region. We're just not confined to Minnesota. So we are in North Dakota, South Dakota. We haven't ventured into Iowa yet, but we've been in Canada over at the International Peace Gardens. And it's been a great ride. There's a lot of great stuff out there to see.
There sure is. Mary, what's your history with the show?
Well, when I moved to Morris, I knew Mike, and he helped me actually do a newsletter. And so I was over visiting with him one day, and I knew that his current host wanted to retire. And so as I was leaving, I said, have you found a new host to take over Prairie Yard and Garden? He said, yep, I did.
Aww.
And I said, that's great. That would be a fun show. And so I went my way, he went his. And about a month later, Mike called me up and he said, remember that day you said that that would be a fun job is to do the show? And I said, yeah. And he said, how would you like to help out with it? And the new host had some medical issues and couldn't continue. And so then I filled in, and man, I think we did something like 10 shows in a month and a half.
That's crazy.
We filmed. And so then as we drove home, I said, so what do you think? He said, well, how'd you like to keep on doing it? And poor guy, he's been stuck with me
well
ever
done.
Since.
Well
so.
Done, Mike. Yeah. How do you capture the beauty of a garden when you see it for the first time? How do you set things up and then figure out how you want to tell people about this beauty that you're seeing for the first time?
Well, there's legwork before that Mary does. You know, we have a list. We have a list of probably 3 or 4 pages of potential shows or locations or people. And we kind of just try to be strategic on what type of shows they are. Mary will do a phone interview or visit. She often visits. And then she'll say, yeah, this is a good show. We come on site. We're only on site for about 4 hours, believe it or not, for a half hour show. We come in, we do our little pleasantries, and we kind of take a look at what's going on, what they're doing. And we'll do an interview right away. We'll get the interview done so we know what to capture. But a lot of the work is from those gardeners themselves. I mean, we can point the camera upside down and still have a great shot in a lot of these areas. And so it just kind of presents itself, you know, color, capturing it in the summertime. We premiere these in January through March. So our audience is just clamoring for color sure. and to see, you know, that whole optimism of the next growing season. So our audience is really devoted to watching us and they like the images. They like the information that we present. We're an educational series. We're not a DIY. I mean, we're not like going to go and renovate somebody's yard. We go and we try to have in-depth conversations with people. So the shots are secondary, I think, but boy, they really look great.
I usually try to develop some questions and let whoever we're interviewing know ahead of time so that they can think about it. And I always say they have the chance to say, no, Mary, that's a stupid question. Don't ask this, but maybe ask that instead. And so they have a chance to look it over and get more comfortable with it. And so then it's a little easier that way. We kind of have a blueprint for what we want to talk about.
When you guys started this, of course, the internet didn't exist yet, pretty much. And when the show was in its infancy. So how have gardens changed because of the influence that we see online? We see in social media, we're peppered with either everyone's great successes or fails and things that worked well for them, but maybe they were in that climate instead of this climate, et cetera. How is it evolving?
Well, for me, I'm not a horticulturist by trade. So, but for me, I would just say or think it would be they see things and they're going to try them. We will highlight 4 or 5 homeowner, you know, private gardens in a year. They just try things, right? They may have seen it in a blog or on, you know, on a website or on an online catalog and try it. And if they fail, they fail, you know, and they've always said that, oh, I just tried and it grew. And if it's the right zone, it's the right zone for them. I think a lot of people are starting to just want to grow things, you know, and I think, you know, even before the pandemic, it was, you know, people want to grow things in their yard, on a patio, if they rent an apartment, whatever it is, they want to grow something to nurture that. So containers and things, displays, and not just a garden of corn and some, you know, beans and that sort of thing. No, this is, I have a patio. It's my oasis, and I have some containers, and I have these types of plants because I like the color or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. And I've seen things on Pinterest, and I want to try that combination. And then as far as technology, I had some people that did a YouTube of their yard and sent it to me and said, we think you'd like coming to visit our place. Well, when I saw that yard, we called and asked, set up a place to come and a time to come and visit them because it was absolutely stunning. So people are using all sorts of neat technology too.
Mary Holm is the host of Prairie Yard and Garden, and Mike Seahawk is the Prairie Yard and Gardens show's executive producer. The show is produced by our friends at Pioneer PBS in Granite Falls, Minnesota, and airs right here on Prairie Public Television, 5:30 a.m. and 12:30 p.m. on Saturdays. All right, you guys. Dave Letterman had his top 10 list. Let's have our top 1, 2, or 3 list of the absolutely most spectacular gardens you have seen in the region.
I don't know if I can pick the top ones because they are all so unique and so wonderful. And it's not just gardens. We visited with a young lady down in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, or she lives near Sioux Falls. And she has a bunch of growers, and then she has those growers bring vegetables, eggs, all sorts of produce to her place, and then she takes them in and delivers them to the people who've ordered using her online website. And so she's producing and bringing fresh food to the families that really want and need them. And I thought that was just
wonderful,
fabulous.
Idea. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And that's how she makes her living. And she has, she had one little girl and she was expecting another. And so this was a way for her to supplement her family's income by doing this wonderful service. So, you know, so that was just awesome to see. And,
I'm going to jump in here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we kind of segment our series of shows of 13. We do 4 shows that are based on homeowners. We have 4 that are based on like public research or, you know, university or government type things. And then we have 4 shows that deal with the industry. And so there's 12, and then we do an arts and cultural heritage show. So that's kind of our season. The one that we did in season 35 that you're going to see here in a few weeks is a lady by the name of Rita Kaiser from Herman, Minnesota. And this is a unique story where she has a corner lot. She has grandchildren. She has her grandchildren have friends in neighboring communities. And what she provides them is a space for them to create a fairy garden. So they parse out their area that they have underneath these large trees, and they create the kids from what age 4 all the way on up to, I think one was going to be a senior in high school.
There was some that were 20. There was one that was 20 something.
Yeah. And they, every year they go and they pick the items that they have in storage for to create their own fairy garden, and they create the theme. And there was how many of this when we shot it? It was 22 fairy gardens, different themes, wow. Golf course theme, fishing theme, a lake, a camping. And so we interviewed the kids as well. And it was just a great community and bonding piece. Very great show, but she's a very special lady. And the kids are just fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, they can come and they have rules there. And the rules will be in the show. So I don't want to give them away. But the kids are very mindful of everybody's fairy garden or their space. And it's a place they can come as often as they want, and they can rearrange their things as often as they want in their own space. And so sometimes children who maybe don't have a lot of home life or guidance, they've got a place they can go that's really theirs. And it was just a marvelous, marvelous show.
Have you sensed that post-pandemic that maybe those who are interested in gardening are becoming maybe a little bit of a younger part of the demographic, that maybe pre-pandemic, you know, the idea was, is I don't want a yard. I don't want to have to keep things up. And I have got to mow and have plants and flowers and things. And now maybe that's become more of a priority. Do either of you sense that?
Oh, heck yeah. If you go to a greenhouse or a place where they, especially houseplants, you know, now they refer to the houseplants as their house babies and or their plant babies. And people are really enjoying, and I think there's a renaissance of people getting back into houseplants, plants in your office. If you watch TV on occasion, if you see advertisements, most of them have plants in the background, and it's just such a thing. And then people have become very in tune with growing their own food. And so I think a lot of people are discovering that too. You know, when I grew up, that was a way of life for us, but I think people are moving back towards that now, is discovering the good quality and the healing quality of growing your own food.
And you don't need to be a homeowner to grow your own food. We often come across individuals who rent, or they own a townhome, or they cannot put a garden in their yard. They have them on their patios, and they're doing them with you know, viney plants. They have trellises and things of that, but they may have a couple of tomato plants and bale gardening. So they're actually putting the seeds, sowing the seeds in the straw of a bale.
Interesting.
With a little bit of soil, a little bit of organic material in there, but growing melons and things. And people are really conscious of growing their own food, or knowing where their food comes from. Mm-hmm. We're seeing, you know, we visited, you know, quite a few last season we did farmers markets. And it's a younger demographic. It is. I mean, yeah, I think you have the gamut of the demographic. Mm-hmm. But we're seeing a lot of young families, a lot of children picking out whatever they're, you know, it's corn or tomatoes or it's apples or whatever it is, they're involved in that, and their parents are trying to teach them that. So healthy foods is where the direction is going. We really try to promote that as much in our series, is growing our own and supporting locally grown producers. And they're in every corner of North Dakota. They're in every corner of Minnesota and South Dakota. And so I think a lot of these associations of like farmers markets and things are doing a really good job of marketing these things in their area, so the producers have a place to sell these. But getting back to, you know, Anna Anderson from Renner, South Dakota, she has an online marketplace. She used to do farmers markets, but she found her niche is, I'm going to do this online so it's convenient. They don't have to come to me, or I have to come to them on a Wednesday evening or a Saturday. I take orders and I deliver it to you. So we're seeing a lot of innovation in locally grown food.
I'm going to go there, because I enjoy the community of farmers markets, but I understand what it is that she's trying to do. Mike, I have a question for you relative to something you said earlier. You talked about spending part of your time relative to research. What are we learning recently, and what is there to research about gardening?
Well, there's a show coming up in season 35 on bee lawns. So Mary Meyer from the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities, and also associated with the Minnesota Landscape Arboretum, she does a lot of research in grasses. And so she is researching and the different types of plants you can introduce into your lawn to promote the health of pollinators in your yard. So just things like that, mm-hmm, is what, mm-hmm, we try to share is, okay, I don't have to just have this immaculate yard. I can do a no-mow grass, you know, which is a lower, you know, type of a fescue or whatever, and I don't have to spend the time to water it and to mow it, but it sustains itself because it's a type of grass that can handle some drought. Things like that is, sure, what we try to promote as options for people to learn about. And again, we're an educational show.
There's a lot of information out there about sustainable gardening for sure. Mm. Mary, take me through your garden. It's beautiful by now, isn't it?
I'm still planting, and you have to bear with me because last year we had to tear out all of our landscaping that we'd done for the last 15 years in our yard and rebuild a septic mound in our backyard.
No. We call it Mount Home in this area.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. And so we are now starting over, and my husband and I dug up 56 perennials and shrubs and moved them to a nurse area until the mound got completed. And so now we are in the process of trying to figure out what we are going to redo. But no, it is not beautiful. We have a retaining wall that was untouched relatively. And so that is usually very beautiful. And we have lots of containers that are also usually pretty nice and feed the pollinators. And bless our neighbors, because they've given me space in their gardens until we can get ours rebuilt.
Well done.
And so,
mm-hmm. Yep. Well done.
People are wonderful.
Mike, we're wrapping it up. Take me through your garden.
Well, I'm a busy person. I have three young children, not young anymore. The oldest just turned 15 and got her permit the other day.
Uh-oh.
But I have a lot of lawn and trees, and I'm in the process of mulching around all the trees and bordering them out. I redid the entire foundation planting about 3 or 4 years ago. And so I wanted something low maintenance for me because I'm in the period of my life where I'm not going to be gardening a whole lot. So I did a lot of different types of shrubs. I just didn't do spirea like you see around a bank. You know, I did some different things. There's a nine bark I introduced and that I put in the front. I just love it's in front of our porch. And we actually had the person that developed that nine bark on our show years ago. This predates Mary, mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. He developed it, and it's called Little Devil, and it's an upright, compact, very dark brown, almost maroonish in some ways, nine bark, and it's just prolific. It's pretty dense. It's really nice, and you can chop it down right in the fall, and it comes back just nice. I also have a sem ash. I like spirea in the corner. That is just taking off well. But, you know, the true gardener in our family is probably my father-in-law, Glenn, lives over here in Morris, and he has a fantastic vegetable garden, and he works in there religiously every weekend. He's a fisherman, but he
has time for the garden, too.
I think the garden is number one priority, to be honest.
Good for him.
And the boat sits in the shed. So we do a lot of canning. We do a lot of freezing. We do a lot of that. So it's the corn. It's the beans. It's the peas. It's everything. And tomatoes. He doesn't eat tomatoes, but he'll grow them for his son-in-law, me. So
Mike Seahawk is the executive producer of Prairie Yard and Garden. And Mary Holm is the host of Prairie Yard and Garden. The show is produced by our friends at Pioneer PBS in Granite Falls and airs right here on Prairie Public at 5:30 a.m. and 12:30 p.m. on Saturdays. To you both, thank you for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you.
It was our pleasure.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Black to the Future is the theme of Fargo-Moorhead's fourth annual Juneteenth celebration, reminding the community that the work of freedom is one we all share together. Activities at NDSU's Renaissance Hall featuring education, entertainment, virtual reality, art, and volunteerism will happen on Saturday, June 17th from 1 p.m. to 7 p.m., and a film and arts festival will follow on Monday, June 19th from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. The celebration is presented by Fred's Dissonance, a nonprofit dedicated to uplifting the global majority.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 6th. One of the largest manhunts in North Dakota history was in 1949 for three men who fled Minnesota after killing a policeman after a burglary and abducting a Mandan patrolman during their flight. Mandan police officer Ralph Sen had pulled the fugitives over on Highway 10 and asked to see their driver's licenses. The men pulled out guns, abandoned their 1935 Oldsmobile convertible, and forced Sen into his squad car. Then they headed south on Route 6. The fugitives crisscrossed South Dakota backroads, making their way to Nebraska. They only traveled at night, with Sen driving at gunpoint. Before being abducted, Sen had radioed for help, but when a strange voice came on to say everything was okay, that heightened the concern. When officers arrived, they found the original getaway car, but the officer and the patrol car were gone. The abduction resulted in nearly 22 hours of searching by law enforcement officers and volunteers. The city of Mandan offered a $1,000 reward for the arrest of Sen's abductors. At 2 a.m. on this date in 1949, with police on their trail, the fugitives released Sen unharmed near Laurel, Nebraska. They abandoned the patrol car in nearby Randolph, Nebraska. Sen walked into Laurel and called the Mandan police chief. The fugitives went on to steal several cars and abduct other hostages on their 1,200-mile, four-day flight through five states. They were eventually captured after one of them surrendered, and the other two encountered a washed-out bridge and plunged into a creek. One of them walked to a nearby farmhouse and asked for help. The owner was the local sheriff's brother. The two fugitives were soon in custody. Meanwhile, the Mandan police chief retrieved Sen's patrol car and drove it back from Nebraska. Sen went to Minneapolis, where he spent a night at the home of a detective whose wife pressed his clothes for him. He attended the funeral of murdered Richfield, Minnesota policeman Fred Babcock Jr. When he flew home, landing in Bismarck, Sen's family, as well as reporters, photographers, and well-wishers, were there to greet him. Sen said he felt fine and was glad to be back. He called his abductors pretty low and sleazy, but also trusting of him. The three criminals received lengthy prison sentences. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
How much does America really understand about its Latino communities?
The narratives about Latinos are inaccurate, incomplete, or sometimes even toxic.
Researchers turn the pages of textbooks and ask what's missing on the next morning edition from NPR News.
4 a.m. to 9 central here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, the big announcement from Governor Burgum. We are joined by reporter Todd McDonald covering the announcement to give us a sense of what happened and what it was like and what his chances might be for reaching the Oval Office. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.